John felt so alone, so defenseless, that he would have welcomed the company of Richie at the moment, even though Richie was the source of all his troubles. But being so was uniquely capable of clearing his name, at least in everything up to the moment they had parted ways. John would still be on his own as to the matter of the country gentleman, but he would be much more believable if it could be established that he bore no personal responsibility for being in this area in the first place. He knew a sudden access of hope, as if lifted on a rising wave. It was by no means too late to set everything right if he could only manage to get someone in authority not to jump to conclusions, but rather listen to his voice of reason. He realized this might be unlikely were he to appear before such an authority looking as he did now. He must get home somehow. He had no money or credit cards, and given his appearance would certainly not have done well at hitchhiking, even if he had not been a wanted man for whom the police would be looking on every highway. He did have the gun. That he could ever consider pointing a firearm at a human being for any purpose whatever would have been impossible throughout his life, up to this moment. Of course he had played with toy weapons as a kid, shooting rubber-tipped darts at brothers and friends, but had had no difficulty, however young, in distinguishing a game from reality, even though that reality had been purely theoretical. He had never seen a real gun being fired, or in movies and TV, though the firearms were genuine, the bullets were not, as everyone, even small children, had always recognized. He had not grown up to be one of those adults who suppose killers get their start by training on water pistols in childhood, or believe that owning a pop gun at the age of 6 created a warmonger who in later life would be eager to nuke the world. Take him. He disliked guns, yet here he was holding one that he had taken with force from its owner so as to save his own life. So far so good, but he had not discarded it. It was the one thing of value at hand. It looked expensive, like the rest of the gentleman farmer's possessions. Perhaps he could sell the weapon or use it as security for enough money to get home. No, that was wrong-headed. His only hope now was to get back in contact with Joni and have her come to pick him up. Even if he found the fare, he could not risk using any form of public transportation. He felt worse the longer he rested. Not only did certain delayed reactions to the struggle for the gun now make themselves known, but his sore knee had returned. The back of his left hand was deeply scratched. Had adrenaline served to numb him to damages received in the struggle to control the gun? Or were the scratches due to the thicket through which he had lately plowed? He pulled himself to his feet. Walking was painful, but he had been strengthened by a resolve to take no more abuse. Although he might have something to explain, he had nothing for which to apologize, and he was determined neither to forget the distinction nor to permit anyone else to do so. In future encounters, he must deal with the probability that strangers would think the worst of him because of his appearance alone. If, in addition, they had heard the same broadcast as the gentleman farmer, and would take him for the wanted man, no argument of his was likely to be listened to. And in a rural area like this, he had to face the possibility that other locals would routinely keep guns at hand. He could not have said how far he walked, having anesthetized himself against time and distance, but eventually he cleared the woods, and there, at the edge of a meadow, on the far side of which some black and white cattle were grazing, was a plain, clapboard structure that needed a new roof, and beyond it, what would seem to be, from the rusty equipment nearby and the dusty, strawy, dim reaches of the interior visible through the open and sagging doors, a working barn. John liked a real barn. As a child, he had once visited an upstate farm owned by a man who had been a pal of his father's in the army, and got to sit on the back of a real horse and in a barn had watched a cow being milked. The fresh milk, however, tasted from a dipper plunged into the pail, was disgustingly warm, but it gave him an affectionate feeling to remember that visit. It was precisely such pretexts for softening that he must guard against now, when he had decided he had no choice if he expected ever to get out of this morass. He must use not violence, he was no criminal, but force, by which he meant the threat or potential thereof. When he knocked at the door, prepared to point the gun at whoever responded, his plan was ruined by the appearance of a bright-eyed young boy.
"Season's not open yet," said the boy, speaking through the screen door. He was full of energy and looked about 12. "If you want to shoot clay pigeons, use the west field," he pointed. "Animals get spooked. Hope you look and see you haven't loaded any deer slugs by mistake. One guy did, last year. They carry further than you think. Came down and hit somebody's pickup driving by. Cracked the windshield."
"I just want to use your phone," John said. The boy was suddenly more guarded.
"Just give me the number. I'll call it for you and give them your message."
"It's not that kind of call."
"Afraid it'll have to be,"
the boy said levelly. It occurred to John that the lad was exercising the caution urged by public authorities, TV advisors, et al., on persons who opened the door to strangers. He himself had certainly been unwise, as it turned out, to respond to Richie's knock that morning, though even in retrospect he could not think of an alternative.
"This is some business between me and my wife." "Sorry,"
said the lad, starting to close the main door.
"That's not good enough. Please wait,"
John cried to the diminishing sliver of boy.
"All right. You call her."
The door stopped closing. Through the narrow gap that was left, he was asked for the number.
"Okay," said John. "We'll be glad to pay you when she gets here. Tell her I'm stranded."
"Where are we, incidentally?"
"Near Meredith? Wherever that is."
"Meredith?" the boy asked derisively.
"This is Beckworth."
"Just tell her how to get here."
"By car? I'm not old enough to have my license yet. I don't know much about roads except just between here and the village."
"That's okay," John said, trying to keep the boy calm. "Fine. Just tell her how to get here from the village. That's Beckworth?"
"Nah, the village that's closest is Bolton."
"Bolton?" John asked. "Okay. Just tell her that, and then what road to take to get here."
"Does she know where Bolton is? Where's she coming from, anyway?"
"She can find Bolton on a map." Desperation was gaining on them again. Joni was an excellent driver, better than he in precision techniques, such as parking parallel to a curb, but she was hopeless with a map, and, uncharacteristically for her sex, had the aversion to asking directions from strangers for which males are traditionally noted. Her explanation was that men might get the wrong idea if so accosted by her.
"Where'd you leave your car?"
the boy asked through the slit between door and jamb, which he prudently had not widened.
"Want me to call the AAA?
I didn't come by car."
"No car? And yet you've got a 12-gauge pump gun?"
The non sequitur made John sigh.
"Would you mind first making that call to my wife? I'll explain while I'm waiting for her. The gun doesn't belong to me. I don't even know how to unload it."
The boy spoke in a sneering tone.
"Then what are you doing with it?"
"I really think I ought to talk to her," John said, turning the weapon to offer it butt first. "I bet living out here you know how to use this. Take it and cover me if you want while I make the call. In fact, you keep the gun as a present from me. I'll repay the guy I borrowed it from."
"No one of these costs?"
the boy asked skeptically.
"You don't have that kind of money. You look like some kind of bum."
It was amazing to John how much the comment hurt him, though it would seem to be the least of his complaints on this day. No doubt it was worse because a minor had made it.
"I'm no bum," he said reproachfully. "I'm a respectable man with a wife and children and job, a good position with a fine firm. I have an excellent reputation in my town, which has many well-to-do residents, including some television personages who paid $1 million or more for their homes, that red-headed woman on the morning news, I don't know if you've seen her, and others. I've just had some bad breaks today, that's all. I'm a good person." "You don't exactly look it."
John lost his temper.
"God damn it, you let me use that telephone!"
The boy slammed the door and loudly latched it. John tried unsuccessfully to open the screen door, but the hook was fastened. He pounded on its frame. There was no response. He had been
stupid to boil over like that. The boy was probably home alone for some reason, maybe recuperating from an illness that kept him from school. So the sick child is threatened by an infamous-looking tramp with a stolen gun. There could now be a list of charges against John for a multitude of crimes he had not committed, some of which had never even occurred. The matter of the truck driver, however, was serious. That could not be forgotten. But not only had he not run the man down, he had called an ambulance on the nearest phone he could reach. He was still utterly clean if he could just find somebody who would listen to and believe him. On an impulse, he ran down from the porch and located where the telephone line came in from the roadside pole. Using the gun barrel as a lever, he forced the wires to rip away from the porcelain connector. If he was not permitted to phone his wife, he would not suffer the boy to make an unwarranted call to the police. This unfairness simply had to stop. He did not deserve it. He returned to the porch and propped the weapon against the wall of the house. Face against the door, he cried, "I'm leaving the gun out here. That should show you how you misjudged me. When I get to town, I'll call the phone company. Sorry I had to put yours out of commission, but you should have believed me." There was no answer, and John had no means of telling whether the boy had heard him. He could have tried to peer in through one of the windows that gave onto the porch, but refrained from doing so lest he frighten the lad even more. He was considerate, even under conditions of extremity. He had come out of the woods on the left side of the house. He began to leave now on the dirt driveway to its right and had almost reached the road when an automobile turned in and stopped abruptly before him. For the briefest of instants, he took it for some sort of official vehicle and believed he had the choice of surrender or flight. But it was Sharon's car, and Richie was behind its wheel. Sharon sat next to him. She looked more alert than when last seen. Richie pointed at the house and asked out of the window, "Who's in there?" John had hoped never to see him again, but the events that had occurred since so changed his feelings that he could put up with the man if it meant getting home. "Nobody." Richie emerged from the car. He stretched in a self-indulgent way and smiled at John. "What are you doing here?" "I might ask you the same, but the hell with it. Let's get out of here." "We can't go anyplace right now by car. The cops have set up roadblocks down there." John could not believe it. "Roadblocks? It's some kind of manhunt?" He sighed. "Then we've got no choice. Maybe they're looking for someone else, someone dangerous, and it's not for us at all. But even if it is us they're looking for, we have to turn ourselves in. That burglary, so-called, was hardly major, and it must be on record that I phoned for an ambulance which should help with the truck driver thing. I'll support your claim that you were saving my life. The tire iron was right there beside him, after all. We can expect trouble, but I don't see why we can't beat the worst of it." To be speaking in this fashion was outlandish for him, and if someone from his old life, preeminently Joni, had appeared at this moment and said, "You got to be kidding," he might have smirked and so conquered the nightmare, gone back inside his house, and after cleaning up the breakfast dishes, put in the rest of a normal day off. But he really was here, not there. And Richie had broken away from him before he finished, bounded up on the porch, and snatching up the gun, slid forward the wooden handpiece under the barrel. He deftly caught the red shell that flew out. "Hey!" he cried with delight. He proceeded quickly to eject all the shells and then reload them into the weapon. John reacted too late. Stepping onto the porch, he said, "That belongs to a guy down the hill. He was pointing it at me, and I had to take it away from him. We'll leave it here." He reached for the gun, but Richie swung it away. "Come on, hand it over." "I'm sorry, John, but I gotta keep it. I need the protection. Cops don't fight fair. They'll be all over the place with machine guns and tear gas, but maybe they won't be able to find us. Let's get that car out of sight." John could no longer regard Richie as being merely an oddball with whom he felt uncomfortable. Even after the running down of the truck driver, he had tried to maintain that illusion, for what was the alternative? He now said aloud, but mostly to himself, All this can't be just because of that hit and run. Richie bounced down one step from the porch, shotgun across his left forearm. John looked around for the optimum route of escape. It would probably be that by which he had come, through the woods. But he had momentarily forgotten the boy inside the house, who would be defenseless if he left. He who had put the phone out of commission. "Come on, John," Richie said. He shouted at Sharon to drive the car to the barn. They followed on foot as she drove slowly along the bumpy, unpaved lane.
"I was going to dump her," he said, "but she's got her uses."
"You can't keep this up forever," John said. "The longer you do, the worse it gets. You can't really be thinking of a standoff with the police." Sharon stopped at the open barn door. Richie yelled,
"Go on in!"
To John, he said, "Besides, she's harmless. Her brain's like a rotten pear." Sharon drove the car inside. When they reached it, Richie told her to put it in neutral and stay at the wheel.
"Do you mind, John?" he asked. "You're stronger than me. Could you roll it over there?"
He pointed to a far corner in the only area not obstructed by partitions or farm equipment in disrepair, including what had once probably been a tractor but was now a rusty relic with two wheels of bare iron. With an effort, pushing against the frame of the driver's window, John was able to get the car moving. Its weight made the old floorboards groan, but once started, it was easy to keep moving. John felt guilty about having deserted Sharon earlier. He spoke to her in an undertone. "Are you okay?" She showed no physical damage. She kept her eyes on where she was steering.
"I'm feeling better. He just drove around looking for you."
"He's no friend of mine."
"Tell him that,"
she said, tight-lipped. She stopped the car and watched Richie's approach in the rearview mirror.
"We can beat him, but you're the answer."
John was taken aback by her new energy. He was not quite sure what she meant and could not ask for elucidation, for Richie was at hand, carrying an old tarpaulin he had found. He barked at Sharon as she left the car.
"Cover up the automobile!"
John helped her with the heavy oil-soaked canvas. When they were done, it was obvious that a car was concealed underneath it, but Richie said it would be sufficient to delude the cops if there was no other evidence that the fugitives had come to this farm.
"We'll get inside the house and keep it buttoned up," he said as they walked back.
He brought up the rear with the shotgun. Sharon was in front. John remembered he had to protect the boy.
"That's really a dead end. Why not hike out through the woods? They're going to be looking for the car for a while, not for people on foot."
"Much as I like you, John, I realize that what you want to do is get caught. So all your plans are going to have that idea back of them." This was so rational a statement as to give John at least a small hope that Richie could be talked to.
"Okay," he said. "But they're going to find us sooner or later, you must know that, and the longer it takes, the worse it looks, the tougher it will be to make your case, and..."
"I don't have a case, John,"
Richie cried in what sounded like glee.
"They have to take me as I come. This is it. Like it or not."
They arrived at the back door of the house. John prayed that the boy would have escaped from one end or side of the building, by door or window, while they were at the other, but knew it was an unrealistic hope. Like any normal human being, the lad would feel most safe in his own home, whatever the menace, with the possible exception of fire or flood. That's what a home is. Beyond its provisions for eating and sleeping, all the fortress most of us will ever require, and John was in trouble only because he had been lured out of his own. As ordered by Richie, Sharon mounted the one-step platform that constituted the back porch, swung the unlatched screen door aside, turned the unresistant knob, and opened the unlocked door. John caught himself before blaming the kid. How could a boy be expected to have the mentality of a combat soldier?
The young fellow was probably crouched in some closet, shaking with terror. Richie would have broken in anyway. Yet John was chagrined to see that Richie had been more successful than he in gaining entrance to the house. Perhaps it was an odd reflection to have at this moment, but had the boy let him use the phone, none of this would be happening. The back door opened directly into the kitchen. Richie came in last. He shut the door and threw the bolt.
How about that for negligence? Living way out here on the hill, no near neighbors, and you don't even lock the door. Anybody can walk right in at any hour of the day or night, take everything you own, and cut your throat while you're asleep.
He stared at Sharon.
You think I'm kidding?
John asked, You've done that? Richie shook his lowered head.
I'd sure like to figure out, before we're done, just what horrible thing I did to you to give you such a low opinion of me.
He raised his face.
I know I've got your gun. I explained it's for self-protection only. I don't go around looking for trouble. I just want to be ready if it comes. You got nothing to worry about, John. I'll get us out of this mess.
Sharon came to life, looking around with a certain enthusiasm.
A kitchen. I'll make coffee.
Neither man responded, but Richie did not attempt to restrain her as she went bustling about, opening cabinets and drawers. John watched her inconspicuously so that he might see where the carving knives were kept. In his own home kitchen, they were conveniently mounted in a slotted chunk of butcher block kept on the countertop. This set of quality German steel had been one of the usable wedding gifts presented to Joni and himself on the occasion of their wedding, a time of hope not so long before as to be forgotten. He could not imagine plunging an 8-inch chef's blade into Richie's person, but he might prove capable of presenting such a weapon as a threat. However, he was across the room from Sharon, and in her search she was soon blocking his line of vision.
They're not going to break in unless they've got some reason to think we're in here, Richie said. So we'll try laying low.
He looked at John.
I want you to give me your word you won't try to signal the cops if they show up.
What I wish you would do, instead of asking for my word, is just once listen to what I'm saying. Richie shrugged.
It seems to me that's what I've been doing all day, John. You've got to admit, if you're being honest, that we wouldn't be where we are if you had let me do the driving back there. I don't like to throw that in your face, believe me. And then, not leaving well enough alone, once I took care of that fat bastard for you, instead of busting into that house and getting the cops on our neck. It would really help if you could just stop this negative way of thinking and see that we're a team. If we can't work together, then we don't have a chance.
I don't have anything in common with you. If you didn't have that gun, I'd... But common sense put limits on John's anger. It might be dangerous to speak so freely to an armed person who was probably demented. He was not obliged to prove anything. He continued so to assure himself when Sharon suddenly displayed some petulance, stamping her foot and saying, I can't find the coffee! And Richie, shifting the gun to his left hand, slapped her so hard with his right that she fell back against the sink. John did nothing. He did not even protest. She should not have provoked the man. She would get herself killed, and even then, what could he do? But self-exculpation is like none at all. He found the energy to go help her stand erect, taking her hand. As he did so, she slipped him an object. A knife. A little paring knife, so dull he did not cut himself while identifying it by touch. Surreptitiously, he placed it on the countertop.
Far be it from me to interrupt this romantic moment, said Richie behind him. But remember, you're a married man, John. That's what I like about you. Now, let's look around this place.
He herded them through the adjoining dining room and into the sitting room that looked onto the front yard, the driveway, and the road beyond through two standard sash windows framed with inner gauze curtains and outer draperies. The couch and a flanking chair had matching slip covers. A big oval rag rug lay before the fireplace. A staircase was at the far end, just beyond the front door. John could see no evidence of any recent renovation, e.g. cast iron radiators were still in place. After peering through the windows, Richie said,
"Just keep back. I noticed when we were outside, you can't see much from the yard. If they come up on the porch, though, and look in, there's no place in here to hide. We could go upstairs, but then we couldn't see much ourselves, and I don't know about you, but it drives me crazy to operate blind. I say at the first sign of anybody, we go in the dining room. The windows there are a little too high to look in from a standing position, and they could get something to stand on, but why do it if there's no other indication anyone's home?"
He addressed these remarks to John as if they would be received sympathetically. John walked away. He wondered where the boy was hiding. He tried not to condemn himself too bitterly for putting the telephone out of order. Richie was right about one thing. A negative attitude did no good. Instead of incessantly deploring all the mistakes he had made, he should concentrate on not making any more, though, of course, if such a concern grew too obsessive, it could become still another negation. Sharon showed no ill effect from Richie's blow. Though she had been silent since, her carriage was spirited, as was the look in her eye. When Richie went to check the lock on the front door, John looked at her. Her response was to pantomime what took him an instant to identify as stabbing. He winced and glanced away. Richie returned.
"Do me a favor, John. Look around and see if you can find a bottle of something."
"Did you drink all that vodka?"
"It was only a pint," Richie said. "I guess it's metabolism. I burn it up in a hurry, don't even feel it."
He surveyed the room.
"Nice here. Is this like your house, John?"
"Not really. This is a lot neater. We've got two little kids."
"Lucky you," said Richie.
John's basic difficulty was that after being at close quarters with Richie for hours now, he had acquired no sure sense of the man, how far he could be pushed. What were the weaknesses that might be used against him? He tried to speak normally. "I do consider myself fortunate. I love my family. Of course, I could always use a bit more income, but the downturn's sure to phase out and business will pick up."
"Did you tell me what you do?"
"Real estate." John was trying to avoid exchanging glances with Sharon. Richie's back was to her. Richie gestured with his index finger.
"Listen, I might throw some action your way. I've been thinking of settling down one of these days. Why not now, in a locality where I've got a friend?"
John realized uncomfortably that the reference was to himself, but he pretended otherwise. "Friends are nice, and I've got quite a few in my town. I grew up there. But my wife's ready to move away to maybe someplace like this in the real country." Richie frowned.
"No good. Too isolated."
He went into a smile.
"Somebody like us might show up. Weren't you going to look for a bottle?"
"Look for yourself. I don't work for you." Richie threw back his head, exposing the cords in his scrawny neck, and groaned.
"You're right about that, and I beg your pardon. Here's a matter I've thought about sometimes, John. The things we hate the most when other people do them are faults that resemble our own. Do you agree? Me? I hate bad manners. People who don't show basic courtesy. And there I go, doing just that myself. Will you please look around for something to drink?
John's bluff had effectively been called. He could not properly protest again in view of the apology, though the same objection remained. He was still being asked to serve. Of course, Richie held the gun.
I'll help,
Sharon said brightly and jumped up from the couch. Richie whirled around, as if in danger from an attack, though he had been presenting his back to her for some moments. John, just embarking on the quest for the bottle, was taken unaware and lost an opportunity to jump him, which Sharon had probably intentionally provided. She had so much more energy than he. She now ignored Richie's menacing posture and went to open the little cabinet used as an end table at the extremity of the couch farther from the fireplace. There was nothing inside but a yellowed newspaper and an empty ceramic vase. John opened the closet near the front door. On a high shelf stood a box of mothballs. Coats of several lengths hung from the rod, and on the floor below was a pair of green boots in rubber or plastic, in either a woman's or a boy's size. He closed the door. Richie had taken a seat on the arm of an overstuffed chair from which he could keep an eye out the window. The butt of the gun was on the floor, the barrel between his knees. Sharon headed for the adjacent dining room.
Where are you going?
Richie shouted angrily.
I'm looking for your liquor. I'll try that sideboard.
Just don't get out of my sight,
he asked John.
Do you think maybe when we get out of this, you might invite me over sometime? You don't have to go to any trouble.
It now occurred to John that the most effective way of dealing with the man would be to pretend to be his friend and abandon the sporadic antagonism that had, after all, been unsuccessful all day. He had waited so long before coming to this conclusion because he was basically averse to hypocrisy in social relations. In real estate, it was another matter. Naturally, you presented a property in its best light and tried to divert a customer from asking about apparent flaws and, if questions were asked, gave answers that avoided candor. He took in more air than he would normally have needed and said,
"Well, why not?" "You mean it?"
John could see that Richie was prepared to be gleeful, and though his intention had been to string him along with a simulation of friendship, he balked at affording him genuine satisfaction. "We're not out of this yet." Richie's mouth went slack.
"You don't mean it?"
"Of course I do, but frankly I can't think of much of anything at the moment, but..." "All right!"
Richie cried warningly into the dining room.
"Get back in here!"
"Wait a minute,"
Sharon called back. "I think I found some." She was squatting in her short, tight skirt at one of the lower compartments of the big old sideboard, a period piece that covered most of its wall.
"Excuse me,"
Richie said to John.
"You were talking about having me over to your house for a meal or something? I tell you, I want to meet your wife. I think I know you fairly well by now, and we've been through some rough times together, which is the only way to know somebody, and I'm just curious about what kind of woman you'd want to connect yourself to on a permanent basis."
For an instant of panic, John saw no means of sustaining his new strategy. Richie's view of their association was unacceptable. He could not permit it to stand. But in the next moment, he was able to remember that his previous vocal rejections of alliance had had no effect whatever. Richie's reality was wholly self-created. John almost bit his tongue, but he actually managed to say with justice, "She's very sensible. She's better with money than me, for example. She'll look for the best price. I'm too impatient. She has good ideas. She's smart." Richie was seemingly studying the rag rug. He nodded slowly.
"Still, I imagine there are times when you'd like to kill her, right?"
John had not forgotten he was speaking to a special kind of man.
No, he said levelly. No, I don't. Ever. But I would kill anybody who tried to hurt her. But if you mean, do we argue from time to time, and sometimes get mad enough not to speak to one another for hours, then sure, that happens. Richie considered the statement briefly, his head at a quizzical dog angle, but when he spoke it was to call abusively to Sharon.
Get back in here, pig!
I thought you hated rudeness. Richie smiled and said, but the truth is the truth.
Sharon had come back with a bottle in her hand. He gestured at it. Sherry, said she. Richie took the bottle and twisted the cap off. He tilted his head back and drank. Then he leaned forward and spat the mouthful on the rug. He hurled the bottle at the fireplace. It got only as far as the hearth and broke, releasing a flow of wine that spread to the wood floor. Again, John found it impossible not to protest.
Was that necessary, to damage this house? Nobody here did anything against us.
Richie squinted.
I know what you're thinking. Will he do something like that when he comes to my house, if my wife serves him something he doesn't like? I know, regardless of what I said about manners, you suspect I don't have any. Well, that's just something I'll have to prove.
He had looked solemn, but now he resumed his smile.
But listen, I just came up with the idea we need to get out of here in one piece. It won't matter how much this place is messed up, spilled drinks or whatever. We're going to torch the dump.
He stared gleefully at John and spun the gun on its butt end.
Simple as that. Create a diversion. By the time the local volunteers get up here, it'll have taken real hold. They'll be occupied for hours, and the cops will have their hands full with traffic, firemen coming in their own cars, rubberneckers, and so on. We can slip out through the woods and down the hill and get out of the area before they're back to thinking about us.
A blackened poker leaned against the outer wall of the fireplace. John was wondering, to what point they had to go before he could actually seize the poker and swing it at Richie's head, and this fantasy did not allow for any self-defense on Richie's part. By gun or any other means, being constructed purely for the purposes of judging what damage John was capable of doing to another human being, but he stuck to his resolve to keep calm. He now even managed to produce a false laugh.
That'll only call attention to us, and bring in more people than ever to clog the roads. We'd hardly be inconspicuous out here where you can bet everybody knows everyone else.
Richie winked at him.
1 minute, you're a regular guy, husband and father, and next you're thinking like a bandit. John, this stuff agrees with you.
Uncomfortable with such praise, John added, and they'll find the car soon enough.
So?
It's registered in Sharon's name, isn't it?
It's not in either of ours. We don't have any connection with her.
It was true that discovering Sharon's identity could lead to nothing. They were three strangers who had been brought together by chance. John was momentarily in the grip of an awful conviction that, in Richie's context, he had no effective argument against burning down a house, any more than he had been able to make clear his objection to running a man down with a car. The best thing he could come up with now was,
look, my business is selling houses, not burning them down.
All right, John, if you feel that way, all you ever have to do with me is state your wishes. You don't want to set a fire? You don't have to.
Richie yawned, throwing his arms wide. The gun could have been snatched from between his knees at this point had John been close enough, but of course he wasn't, being instead near the poker, which he had already rejected as a weapon, for it could deliver too fearsome a wound. He would do anything he could to get the problem solved without any further hurt to anyone, including Richie. Nothing was more important than avoiding violence. Richie stood erect, the gun barrel over his left forearm, the butt in his armpit.
I'm willing to do all the dirty work and take responsibility for it, but it would just be nice if I got a word of commendation once in a while. Let's face it, I could have run off hours ago, leaving you in the lurch. What's keeping me around? Am I making any money?
John could not help saying, I really do appreciate what you're doing for me. He had not gone too far. Richie seemed sheepish.
Well, okay. That's all right.
He strolled to the couchside cabinet, bent, and removed the yellowed newspaper. He found a little box of matches on the mantelpiece. John could have kicked himself for overlooking them, for they might have been useful. Richie went to the staircase, where he set fire to the bald sheet of newsprint and threw it onto a step. During most of this sequence, taking advantage of the distraction, John was looking at Sharon and trying to get across to her, through facial expression alone, that patience and caution were needed. But looking past him, she now cried out. He turned and saw the flames, which were only blackening the riser of the step that held the loose ball of blazing paper. The latter was already almost consumed. He felt a sudden triumph over Richie, who was too ignorant of the basic rules of reality to know that you could try all day in vain to burn a house down in that fashion. Arsonists always use an inflammable liquid. Richie suddenly peered up the staircase and raised his gun to the ready.
Come on down here.
It was the boy. He descended the steps, displaying no fear, even though the gun was pointed at him. When he came to the blackened ash, still glowing at points and in more or less the same bald shape in which it had been formed, he stamped it into fragments and asked straightforwardly,
Why are you trying to burn this house down?
Don't get fresh with me, Richie said. If I was trying to burn a house down, it would look like that paper.
Then what are you doing?
The boy asked. He had reached the living room, and he saw the smashed bottle and flood of wine. He had addressed the question to John, who shrugged guiltily and said,
We're just resting here temporarily, if you don't mind, and...
Well, I do mind, the boy said. You broke in. You burned the stairs. You're a gang of crooks.
No, said John. No, that's not true. If you had let me explain earlier...
You cut the phone off,
said the boy. He now stared at Sharon.
Hey, John,
Richie said merrily.
You didn't tell me that.
Sharon smiled at the boy.
Hi, what's your name?
The boy retained his solemn expression.
Tim. Mine is Sharon, Tim. Don't worry about your house. We won't stay long, and I'll clean up that mess if you show me where the mop is.
You're not going to do anything, Richie told her. Are you alone here, kid? Don't lie. You'll regret it.
I'm not lying. My father doesn't live here since last year. My mother works at the school cafeteria, and then she stays on for the accounting class in adult ed.
Don't you go to school?
It's over for today. The bus just left me off before he got here.
He nodded at John.
Kid, you're in luck, said Richie. If you hadn't come downstairs and I had to go look for you, you would have got hurt. Just do what you're told with no smart mouth, and you'll be all right.
We don't have any money, said the boy.
If that's what you're after, my father didn't leave any behind when he took off.
Richie grimaced.
We don't need to hear your troubles. We just want your house right now. We feel like burning it or throwing wine around, then we'll do it. We'll shoot your cows out there if we feel like it.
They're not ours, said the boy. We rent out that field.
Tim,
Sharon said.
Come on over here and sit by me. You'll be okay.
Richie smirked at John.
Look who's talking.
To the boy, who had not accepted Sharon's invitation, he said,
How'd you like a piece of that, huh? You old enough? You just play with yourself, right?
Let him alone, John said, trying to sound indifferent. He won't cause any trouble. We have to think of how we're going to get out of here. Richie nodded, but he seemed fascinated by Tim.
I can remember myself at that age. I lived with these foster parents. He caught me playing with myself.
Yeah, said John, repelled. What do we do if the police don't come around, or if they do and then go away? Have you figured that out yet? What will we do in the long run? I can't keep running. I've got a family to take care of, a job, a life to live.
Don't worry, said Richie. I'm always several steps ahead of the situation.
He patted the barrel of the gun, with what significance John could not, and should not have wanted to, understand, and then, without a transitional phrase, went back to his reminiscence.
I tried to stick it back in my pants, but he says, Hey, let me give you some help with that, and comes over and...
Ah, John interrupted. There's the boy and Sharon. Richie barked with laughter.
That's what she does for a living.
He swung the gun's muzzle toward the crotch of Tim's jeans.
Play your cards right with me. Maybe I'll have her do it to you. Would you like that?
Maybe John could have successfully jumped him then, but the instant came and went. Sharon had not replied to one of Richie's verbal assaults all day. Perhaps it was the boy's presence that caused her to do so now.
No, she said. I'm not a prostitute. What you're saying is not true.
Richie turned to John as if seeking support. John looked at the rug.
She's a cocktail waitress. They're all for sale.
That's a lie, Sharon cried.
How about it, kid?
Richie asked Tim, and now he poked him in the groin with the muzzle. The boy bent and backed away. Suddenly he uncoiled and made a dash for the dining room. There was an instant in which John could have made his move, hurling himself at the gun, diverting its aim to the floor so that if the trigger was pressed, no one would have been hurt, but the next moment Richie was out of range. The man had the reflexes of an animal and such speed that he caught Tim before the lad got far, yoked him with the gun, marched him back. Richie leered at John.
This little bastard needs to be taught a lesson. I had respect when I was his age. Somebody bigger and stronger than me, I listened to them.
He pushed the boy onto the couch and put the gun to his face.
Get those pants down. I'm going to show you how they did it to me when I was younger than you.
Using his left hand, gun in his right, he began to zip down his own fly. Sharon's eyes appealed to John, but there was nothing he could do at this moment. He felt that anyone who would judge him must realize what a gun could do to human flesh. It would probably be necessary to let Richie begin the act before an effective move could be made against him. This might prove to be the diversion that was so sorely needed. Thus, John made no protest now. Instead, he turned, as if washing his hands of the matter, and gazed out the window, and saw a police car glide soundlessly to a stop on the road in front of the house. Behind John, Sharon was screaming. He whirled around. She had moved on Richie, who was in the act of thrusting her small body away. John looked out again at the car. The cop was still inside it and had probably not heard the scream. This was the time to jump Richie, who would certainly ambush the policeman if he knew he was coming, but before John had taken the first step, the officer left the vehicle and slammed its door too loudly not to be heard inside the house. Richie's reaction was instantaneous.
Get in the dining room!
The command applied to them all. Gathering John in, he herded them with gestures of the gun barrel.
Everybody sit down on the floor.
They were lined up between the sideboard and the dining table in too narrow a space for any to sit next to another. Their captor knelt in the rear. He leaned forward and quietly asked John, who sat just ahead of him,
"You looked out. Who is it?"
John decided to embellish the truth. "The police."
"How many?" "I just heard one door."
"I don't know. I only glanced. You look."
"That's the kind of mistake I don't make,"
Richie whispered. He raised his voice slightly so the others could hear.
"I'll blow the back out of anybody who makes a sound."
They could hear the policeman on the wooden porch. He pounded at the same door John had knocked on earlier, and not long thereafter could be heard to walk, boards squeaking along part of its length, probably peering through the windows into the living room. During this sequence, Richie leaned past John and poked Sharon next in line with the long gun, then did the same to Tim. Of course, he thereby offered John another opportunity to disarm him, overextended as he had to be to reach the boy. Very little lateral force would have been needed to divert the long barrel. Had Richie pulled the trigger then, the shot would have alerted the officer outside without harming any of the captives. John decided that what he should do henceforth, rather than brood about his past delinquencies, was to keep himself in a state of mind that made him ready for the next opportunity. But that was a difficult thing to manage, for he was neither an officer of law enforcement nor a combat-trained soldier. He had been thrust into an extreme condition through no fault of his own, and he recognized that he was whining and felt shame. He was supposed to be a man. How could he have defended his wife and children had this criminal gained entrance to his house? Tormented by the thought, he would now have wrested the gun from Richie, but as things seemed to go with those who live by excuses, he was not offered a second chance of the same kind. The policeman could be heard to descend the porch steps, surely en route to the rear of the house and then the barn. Would he find the car? If so, the situation would change dramatically. He would radio for reinforcements, and an army would arrive to besiege the house. What Richie might do in such a predicament provided good reason for worry. Mass carnage was not out of the question. But the next exterior sound was that of the car starting up and driving away. John was enraged. The policeman had not even taken the trouble to walk around the house, let alone inspect the barn. What a lousy job the cops had done thus far today. They had not come close to catching anybody. He was aware of the irony in which anybody included himself, but he refused to surrender to the state of mind, well known to TV journalists, by which hostages begin to identify with their captors. While it was true that when not in Richie's company he had himself disarmed the man who held him for the arrival of the police, his intent had not been criminal. Obviously, his judgment had since been proved wrong. If only he had tolerated the gentleman farmer's threats and waited to be taken into custody, he would at worst have worn handcuffs for a while and endured an hour or so under arrest, perhaps not even behind bars, before Joni brought a lawyer to spring him. Richie now stole around the other side of the table and crept into the living room, there cautiously to peep out at the road. He soon rose from the crouch and motioned with his gun.
"Back to the party!"
John was determined not to accept any further molestation of either Tim or Sharon, to intervene regardless of mortal danger, but as it happened, Richie was in another mood now.
"I don't like this. He left too soon. He might be a hick cop, but even so, he'd look around more. He saw something."
Richie asked John.
"Don't you think?"
John shrugged. "Sure, that's it." Richie gestured at the others.
"Come on. We're going to look. If I'm right, he'll be back with World War III. I can't waste time."
He ordered Sharon to unlock and open the front door, and she did so. John was relieved that the command had not been given to Tim, who wore a more rebellious expression than ever.
The aborted rape had not broken his spirit. That was good for his own sense of self, no doubt, but a precipitate move might get him hurt as well as damage the general cause. Outside, Richie said, "Look around, John. What could he have noticed?" Could this be a sincere question? Did Richie actually trust him to do as asked and then report truthfully? He didn't see anything. Everything looked completely normal, so he decided there wasn't any reason to hang around. I imagine they're searching a pretty wide area if they got up here and probably don't have that much time and men to spare on wild goose chases. Richie was smiling.
Always look on the bright side, don't you? That's why I like you.
But that's also why you're at a disadvantage when it comes to the police. You forget they carry guns. John could not resist saying, I can't forget you've got one. Cops' guns don't worry me.
That was before this, Richie said smugly. See what happens next time. All they need is an excuse.
He was surveying the facade of the house.
You're right, I can't see anything either.
He led them on the tour around the building that the policeman had not made. When they were on the front lawn again, Richie stared at the road.
Still, I've got this instinct. I'm always right when it comes to people who want to do me harm. That's the only reason why I'm alive today. I'm a hard one to take by surprise. That's my game. I take care to see it's not used against me.
Who in hell are you? John asked suddenly, surprising himself. The question seemed to startle Richie, too. He winced, as if having difficulty in finding an answer that would suffice. As he stared into the middle distance, Tim broke away. Sprinting with the speed of an animal, the boy gained the corner of the house before Richie got the gun to his shoulder. Richie, too, was fast, but he had really been taken off guard this time. He dashed to the corner but turned back quickly to shout at the others,
"Come on, we'll get him!"
So Tim had made a successful escape. John joined Richie to say with satisfaction, "You'll never catch him now. Nobody can run like a kid." Richie snorted.
That might be true if he had headed for the woods, but he's not that smart. He went into the barn. Come on.
You're the dumb one, Sharon said, wobbling along on her high heels. What about the cop who's coming back with World War III? The remark infuriated Richie, but did not divert him from his purpose.
You're gonna get yours once and for all. Missy, just wait.
Why not now? Asked Sharon, you yellow-bellied sapsucker. John held his breath. He knew what Sharon was trying to do, but believed it might be a mistake. Richie made an ugly laugh and said,
You silly whore, you. You actually think you can distract me? You're not going to save that little punk any more than you're going to save yourself, I promise you.
They had reached the barn doors, which looked to be as firmly closed as when they had left them so, but Richie had presumably seen Tim enter the building. He asked John to open the doors.
What's the problem?
They're fastened from inside, John said, putting his weight against the big panels. But they were hinged to swing out, not in. He put his eye to the space between them, but could not see the latch. Probably something simple, just to keep them from blowing open in bad weather if somebody's working inside. John stepped back. If I had a piece of wire, I could probably slip it in and lift whatever's there. He did not ask himself why he was being so helpful, but he hoped that Sharon would understand. As long as he kept Richie occupied with details, nobody was being hurt. But she did not.
Why are you helping him? She cried. Can't you see he's going to kill us when he's ready?
Okay, Richie said with glee. Then I won't wait.
He raised the gun. She ducked under it and kicked him in the crotch with her pointed toe. He howled in pain and outrage, but still hung on to the weapon. Sharon was trying to wrap herself around the barrel while avoiding the muzzle. She and Richie wrestled each other to the ground. Though impaired, he remained the stronger. John watched this in a state of paralysis.
He had lost his nerve entirely, but had not understood that until this moment. All of it was simply too foreign to his nature. He had been able to struggle with the gentleman farmer only because the man seemed ready to kill him. Apparently, he had so exhausted his moral energy that Richie was likely to murder Sharon after besting her in this fight did not move him. And yet, watching himself as though from the perspective of a neutral bystander, he felt a shame so intense it was almost pleasure. Richie was prying her fingers from the gun barrel, perhaps breaking them one by one in the process. It was an ugly sight. John turned his back on it. He looked down the driveway to the road and saw that he might escape while Sharon kept Richie occupied. Enough of a head start, and it would not be worthwhile for Richie to chase him. He would be halfway down the hill to the roadblock. Meanwhile, Sharon and Tim could hide in the woods. The fact was, Richie would surely kill her as soon as he regained control of the gun, but he would not harm John in any way. He had made that clear again and again, and in return, John had not really resisted him. A fair exchange, and as loathsome a transaction as John had ever made, but one that had thus far ensured his future as husband and father, which was necessarily always his fundamental concern, secure against the claims of personal pride, compassion for strangers, chivalry.